Hello and welcome to Bondcast, a podcast series where we discuss our views on the latest themes and events shaping rates markets. I'm Imogen Bakra, head of non-dollar rate strategy, and I'm joined today by our global market specialists, Jan Navruzzi and Joanne Spadigam. Okay, we've had a week this week. Well, we've not finished it, as always. We're recording this on Thursday, but we've had a week where it's really been the data that's been driving markets. Most obviously, I think, in the US and in the UK. So perhaps that's the best place to start. Jan, CPI and retail sales have been the two big data prints in the US this week. On the surface, perhaps look like they're giving two slightly different messages, I suppose, in terms of the read across for markets. But what's your takeaways from what we've learned this week?
That's right. And I think CPI is probably the more important out of the two. But unfortunately, the inflation numbers surprised a little bit to the upside. Just to kind of give a little bit of a context in the monthly changes on the headline side, which includes food and energy, the increase was 0.3 on month. We expected that most people expected 0.2. Pricing ahead, derived from inflation markets was even less than that. If you look at the core component, that increased by 0.4, most expected 0.3. So a little bit above. I don't want to go ahead and say, oh, the disinflationary process stopped we've kind of reversed trend by any means, but it's certainly not great news. And digging deeper a little bit more into the report, we can see that there was a kind of like a bifurcation of where the strength came from and where the weaknesses. And if anything, the split between services and goods got even larger. Core goods contributed to outright deflation again for the 8th straight month in a row. Core goods fell by like 0.3 month on month, largely driven by things like used car sales and medical care commodities, apparel, some like household furnishing. Those are all moderated drops. Those all posted drops on a monthly basis. On the other hand, we had core services going up by 0.7. That's not good news, right? Because that can be a little bit stickier, as services tend to be a little bit stickier and kind of like in direction of travel, but also it's also not what the Fed wants to see, because that's been the main contributor to inflation. And a large portion of that came from the shelter side, which increased by 0.6 for January. As a reminder, that was 0.4 in December. So quite the big increase, and that's driven by things like hotels, but also largely by what we call the owner's equivalent rent, which kind of tries to replicate a rental measure for people who own their homes, right? So, I mean, on the other hand, the pure rent measure was up only by 0.4. So there could be some seasonality factor in there, because the start of the year, there's also a little bit of noise with the seasonality resets. The seasonal factors were updated the week before too, as we discussed last week. So there was a little bit of possibly boost to OER from there too. So again, I don't want to downplay the impact of the beat that we saw in inflation, but it could be a little bit quirky because of seasonal factors. This is probably not the platform to get too much into details, but it's hard for me to kind of hold back. But when you think about which regions were impacted by increasing shelter costs, it's mostly, it was driven, for example, by the South, which has a lot more ownership and can contribute a lot more to OER than you would get from places that contribute more to their pure rental measure. So things like that added, but it definitely changes the picture a little bit as, we think some of the strength will carry over into February as well. And that in turn has implications for the Fed, right? Like the Fed wanted to see more of the good data that we already had. This was arguably not one of the similarly good data. It wasn't significantly worse, but it was not, what they were looking for. And you had that in combination with very strong labor market data. You had that in combination with ISM services that was also pretty strong. We're not really falling off a cliff. And you mentioned retail sales, which kind of counters that a little bit, because retail sales showed the 0.8 decline for the month of January. Even the core component, if you exclude autos and gas, also fell by 0.6. The component that goes into GDP, what we call the control group, also fell by 0.5. So that's going to moderate consumption a little bit. But because we finished fourth quarter in such strong momentum that we still expect to see positive contribution of consumption for the year, even though, you know, the month-on-month decrease was there was a decrease in sales. So so retail sales probably doesn't shift the dynamic that much for the Fed, but it did show some deceleration. Again, not to exaggerate its impact, because we did finish the year on a pretty strong note. And that has to be kind of considered in calculating Q1 GDP as well.
I guess the obvious question then, as a follow-up to all of that, is really, what does this mean for your Fed call? You sounded more hawkish than I normally hear you sound there, Jan. So I'm guessing that there's some updates on that front.
Yeah, I almost teed it up there, you know, just kind of like left one blank spot in there. I was like, oh, what about the Fed? And you're right. And we are changing our Fed call now. I think, you know, just to take a step back and look at what I think we got right and what I think we got, what appears to be wrong now, is the timing seems right. We estimated May. Now we're pushing it back to the first cut to June. And we had that, you know, call from last year, which at the time markets were, you know, completely in the other direction. And until we got kind of this year-end rally, we were almost an outlier of, you know, people were, did not think a May cut as soon as May was really in the cards. So now we've pushed that back to June. What I think now is shifting is that we see the cuts in 25 basis point increments rather than the 50 that we expected before. And listen, I think that largely comes back to the fact that growth is strong. And that has been, I think I've said this same exact thing last week's pod too, but the disinflationary process has been strong enough to justify cuts earlier in the year, but the weakness in growth has not been as large as we expected, which in turn would have contributed to larger increments in cuts. So when we don't have that, unless we get a very sharp turnaround in growth, we think the base case for them is probably 25 now. Even some of the more dovish, you know, officials from the Fed, let's just say like Chicago Fed's Goolsbee, even he pointed out that, you know, he's not going to comment on 50 basis point cuts. So if he's not willing to kind of fight that battle, I don't think anyone else is going to go ahead and say that we need to do more rather than just like the standard increment. So, so 25 starting in June at each meeting going forward, and 50 and 50 again in the first two meetings of the next year, which still brings the rate closer to the Fed's target rate to 3.25% over a longer period though, and slightly above their current neutral estimate, which is probably a reasonable guess. And if you look at before pandemic versus now, all else equal, it's hard for me to make the case that any estimate of neutral rate would be lower, particularly given in light of much larger fiscal structurally larger fiscal spending, and like the dynamism in the labor market. So what happens next year? Lower confidence, of course. So the recession has been quite elusive, but so we've shifted, to summarize, we've shifted our Fed call for the first cut to start in June from May, and we've downsized our cut increments to 25 basis points from 50 basis points, but kind of like the terminal rate still gets close to where we expected it to be before. All right, that's probably enough for from the US for now, and let's switch to the UK, where we also had a very busy week of data. Can you give us the main takeaways?
Yeah, I think as ever with the UK data, when there's so many data prints and so many different kind of indices within all those prints, there's kind of something for everyone. And we said last week that, you know, if you were at the more dovish end of the spectrum and you were biased to being long the front end in the UK, which is where we felt consensus was, then you probably wouldn't get much in the data to change your mind this week. But on the flip side, you know, in line with our base case, which is a kind of later August cut and perhaps 100 basis points of easing this year, we also didn't see anything that would kind of call that into question either. I guess just taking the prints that we did have quickly in chronological order this week, of course, we started the week with the labor market data on Tuesday. Wage inflation eased, but not as much as expected. Perhaps more concerning for the BOE was the fact that there were also upward revisions to previous months. So if you recall, the upward revisions in Q1 2023 were what became quite problematic for the Bank of England. And that's really what they're worried about this time round, is the upside risks, but those risks that might stem from upward revisions to previous months in the data. And also on the employment and the unemployment data, they were clearly still indicative of a very tight, perhaps tighter labour market, although there's lots of question marks around the kind of survey size and the sampling of that data. So it's difficult to have too much certainty in the direction of travel, I suppose, in terms of whether it's getting necessarily tighter, but I think we can conclude that the labour market is still very tight. Governor Bailey, in front of the Lords Economic Affairs Committee this week, in my view, somewhat played down the kind of problems with the data and saying, you know, whether the unemployment rate is at 3.8%, as the new kind of experimental series shows, or it's at 4.2%, which is what the old data set showed for the last couple of prints. It's difficult to pinpoint exactly where the unemployment rate is within that range. But nonetheless, I sort of reading between the lines, I think he was saying, you know, regardless of whether it's 3.8 or 4.2, it's still tight. And the trends on the inactivity side in terms of the labour participation rate are not encouraging, you know, to the extent that the fall in the unemployment rate is being driven by a rise in inactivity, and that rise in inactivity is being driven by a rise in those that are identifying as long-term sick and are therefore not in the workforce in the UK. It's difficult to see that kind of going into a very rapid reverse. So on the labour market side, I think we're comfortable with this idea that, you know, for centrist BOE members that are looking for more evidence that wage inflation is coming off and allowing inflation to trend sustainably back towards target, there was nothing in there that made us confident that they would be cutting earlier than August. On the inflation side, that was marginally better news, I suppose, if we're thinking from a BOE perspective. Inflation at both the headline level and the core level remained constant. So headline was at 4.0, core was at 5.1, when both were expected to marginally tick up. So that was the good news. The less encouraging news, I suppose, is that services inflation still rose. It's still well above 6% in the UK. It didn't rise as much as expected. So again, slightly encouraging, but it's still, like I say, for those centrist BOE members who are looking for evidence of, you know, easing inflationary pressures and looking for that service price inflation to come down, that clearly wasn't particularly encouraging. One thing that stood out to me this week from Bailey's communication or Bailey's testament in front of the Lords Economic Affairs Committee was that, of course, the opening gambit was, you know, this is surely good news on the inflation front that it didn't rise as expected. And he was quite careful not to say that this was good news. You know, his assessment of the situation was we are pretty much back to where we were at the February MPC, essentially. You know, we had a marginal upside surprise last month and a marginal downside surprise this month, but all in, we're talking about quite small numbers, and neither of them really kind of move the needle, I think, when it comes to the MPC's reaction function. Finally, we still have retail sales tomorrow, of course, but we're recording this on Thursday afternoon. So finally, from where we are now, we had GDP data this morning, which showed was weaker than expected for the Q4 measure, which is, I think, the important measure here. And that showed that the UK was officially in a technical recession. So two consecutive quarters of negative growth at the end of last year. Given the kind of concerns around the persistence of inflation, I think we're in an environment where the Bank of England is clearly placing much more weight on the inflation side of things. So the inflation data, the wage inflation data, the tightness of the labour market, than on the activity data in its reaction function. So the GDP data matters a little bit less. And I guess in that vein, Governor Bailey, again, in front of the Lords Economic Affairs Committee, kind of played down this idea of the UK being in a technical recession. Now, of course, this was before the data, so he didn't know that it was going to be marginally weaker than the Bank of England had expected. But he talked about the fact that essentially the Bank of England's projections for the UK being in recession at the end of last year were pretty finely balanced. And he kind of instead pointed to the fact that actually the forward-looking indicators suggested a bit of a pickup. So he sort of dismissed the, I guess, importance of being in a technical recession, as did Megan Green, who spoke after the data had been published. One thing I think that's came out of our conversations over the last couple of weeks with clients is those that were more biased to being long the front end of the UK and kind of buying into this kind of earlier cutting narrative, talked a lot about the fact that, you know, if we were in a technical recession and the headline, the media would kind of focus on that. And also you have headline inflation coming back very close to target in the near term, which the Bank of England does expect. Then Bailey was going to come under a lot of political pressure and it was going to be hard for them to push back against rate cuts in that environment. You know, we're in a recession and headlines back at target. Why aren't they cutting rates? To which I would just flag that, you know, to the extent that people care about where rates are, you know, the average person really cares about where their mortgage rate is than anything else. You know, a lot of people couldn't actually tell you, I don't think, where bank rate, the level of bank rate is. And to the extent that the market is already pricing in some easing and mortgage rates have had to come off, I think that that buys, you know, the MPC a bit of time or a bit of a cushion against some of that public criticism. Of course, there comes a point where the MPC either has to validate that market pricing or it backs up. And in fact, we've seen it back up a little bit already, in which case it opens the door to a little bit more kind of public pressure. But whether he succumbs to that is another question. But I don't think it's necessarily true that just because we're in a recession and headline inflation might dip closer to the Bank of England's target in the near term means that they have to cut rates especially quickly.
And as it was with my Fed tee up, the obvious question here is, what is that? Where does all of that leave your market views?
So, like I said, it doesn't change our base case view for the Bank of England. You know, as I said before, you can kind of find enough in the data, whether that be the kind of downside on the CPI, the upside on the wage inflation, et cetera, to justify whatever your prior narrative was. For us, our base case remains that the Bank of England cuts in August and they cut 100 basis points this year, which actually, when you compare it to market pricing, seems like a relatively more dovish outcome now, or at least markets now are more on side with our view that those cuts could come later. And actually markets have kind of closer to sort of 75 basis points of easing being priced in as we speak. We've moved clearly a long way from, you know, in the last couple of weeks from the highs of kind of 150 basis points of easing being priced in. And now from a market perspective, I think we're much closer to being in a sort of fair range. You know, our view of the MPC was that they kind of endorsed easing of around 75 to 100 basis points this year. We're at the lower end of that range. Which I think makes sense. You know, I think there's lots of reasons to think that we shouldn't be necessarily at the higher end of that range, in part because this week's data is really only part of the puzzle. You know, the centrist members on the MPC have been very clear that they need to see more evidence of inflation trending sustainably back towards a target. So this week's data should always have been viewed through the lens of, you know, the next 3 months in totality, I guess. And so pricing 100 basis points of easing with certainty at this point feels unlikely. Like I said, the kind of labour market data won't have done anything in terms of alleviating the Bank of England's concerns around upside risks when it came to the upward revisions to last month. Similarly, around the tightness of the labour market and also around the fact that services inflation ticked up again this month. And thirdly, because I think we're seeing, as you've already been through, Jan, kind of evidence that, you know, inflation data elsewhere, or especially in the US, is you know, this kind of last mile narrative, and the difficulty of bringing that back to target is evident. And so against that backdrop, you know, with front end rates increasingly correlated everywhere, I think it's hard to see us getting back to the kind of dovish extremes of pricing that we have been at. I think the market reaction to the data this week has been quite telling too. You know, for all that everyone seemed desperate to be long the front end of the UK curve over the last couple of weeks. You know, clearly the backup in rates and the flattening in the curve that we've had over prior to the data acted as a bit of a positioning washout. And I think we saw that especially after the US CPI print. But even after the kind of downside surprise, if you like, on inflation and on GDP, we've basically just retraced to those sort of pre-CPI levels. It feels like there's limited appetite at this point for everyone to kind of pile back into longs again. But that said, you know, the data is well behaved, and so, you know, the extent to which we can sell off from here is from a front end perspective is perhaps a bit limited too. And so, you know, for the rest of the curve, that leaves you in a position where front end pricing is kind of middle of a range of what we would call fair, and probably relatively well pinned for now, with the Bank of England meeting out of the way, with the key data prints out of the way. And so what are we left with looking forward to over the next couple of weeks? And I think that, you know, in that environment, we return to thinking about supply risks in the UK. We're heading into the budget, spring budget. We'll be thinking about our preview next week. And of course, everybody else will too. So focus pretty quickly will shift to, you know, that heavy supply outlook. And I know we return to the same theme every week, but we are starting to see clearer signs of supply indigestion, I think, here in the UK with the 10-year auction this week, in the euro area too, with some weakness in French auctions and EU auctions, for example. And of course, the market may well be nervous about that ahead of next week's relatively heavy supply week with the mediums APF, the medium Bank of England quantitative tightening operation on Monday, and then long end supply around the middle of the week as well. So I still think that, you know, there's limited reasons to think that yields should be much lower than where we are, and probably risks are skewed towards higher yields rather than anything else. That's enough from me. That was a bit of a monologue, wasn't it? Joanne, I'll move over to you. It's been a bit of a quieter week, I should say, in comparison to the top tier data that we've had out of the UK and the US in the euro area. But there was some second tier data. We've had IP, we've had ZEW. How are you thinking about all of that this week?
Yeah, so European rates were really driven quite a lot by what was happening in the UK and the US this week. But I think in terms of the second tier data, the industrial production data in Europe came in much higher than expected, but we're not really reading into those numbers. It does seem that it was a statistical issue, well, a statistical factor that led to this higher than expected industrial production number, and that includes industrial production in Ireland being particularly high, and that's because of tax reasons and not because of an actual underlying strength in the economy. So I think that even though that number was higher than expected, if you take away from the distortions in the data, we still get this fairly stagnant picture for Q4 confirmed in that industrial production data. I think what does help is that the ZEW, which came in slightly better than expected, does really play into the story we have of growth over this year really being a bit more resilient than it was last year, where this improvement in expectations is in line with previous averages and not really below average like we are seeing on other data prints. So I do think the overall picture of growth in Europe improving this year, where we see that improving because of an increase in real incomes, seems to be something that is tracking in expectations data at least. So in terms of our ECB call, I think it really reinforces the fact that if the growth picture in Europe continues to be fairly resilient over this year, the need for a quick and pronounced rate cutting cycle isn't one that we see at this point.
I guess you sort of taken a bit of an advantage of a quieter week on the European side to do some thinking about the ECB's operational framework. Credit to you, you were thinking about this before the two sources pieces that have come out today around that. But have you, I guess, combination of the work that you've been doing and what we've learned from those sources pieces, have you got a conclusion of what direction you think that the ECB is going to take in, you know, in the conclusion of its operational framework, which I believe is expected in the spring?
So I think it's pretty interesting. Of course, we're at a level of reserves at the moment, which are really, really high. Like, we don't see a situation where this operational framework becomes useful at this point in time, unless they start to rapidly shrink the balance sheet. Of course, telcos are running off this year, which does reduce the size of the balance sheet. But because they've chosen a passive unwind of asset purchases at this stage in time, it won't take a while before we get to that level where reserves in Europe are scarce. But when we do get to that level, of course, the operational framework and what the ECB decides becomes an important consideration. That I think what we've learned from the sources article, as well as from previous ECB speakers, is that they're quite unlikely to use this Fed model where we have a system with ample reserves. So really, they're looking to take an approach more similar to the BOE, where they do actually remunerate or allow for banks to tap into their facility to get reserves at a level, at any level they would like, at a rate that's predetermined by the ECB. I mean, there's a few ways they could do this. I mean, the ECB currently has the MRO, where banks can tap that for 1 week liquidity, and that's priced at the deposit facility rate plus 50. So, I mean, the rate on that facility is quite high at the moment, which makes using it quite costly for banks. So you don't really get large uses there. So one of the things that the ECB could do is just shift that rate lower. Either similar to the Bank of England, they have a facility where they price liquidity providing operations at the deposit facility rate, given that it's the effective rate in the euro area, or even slightly above it. So they have a small corridor where the effective policy rate can lie. So I think one of those two options will likely be adopted. They can obviously leave the corridor as it is, but it does mean that the effective policy rate will shift from being the deposit facility rate to somewhere in between that and the MRO. So I think that will cause a bit of volatility in the short term. And of course, I think an implicit tightening in policy if they do leave the MRO where it is. But I definitely think some form of facility where banks can tap into reserves and get that at a level that is close to DFR seems quite likely at this stage.
I presume, given your assessment that we're far away from the point at which banks would need to use that facility anyway, means that the market impact of announcing such a tool at this point is probably quite limited. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say the market impact is quite limited at this point. I mean, I think, of course, the ECB is not necessarily in a rush to get this corridor or this facility in place, because we're so far from it. So, I mean, I think in terms of the timeline when it comes in, that's also uncertain at this point, but I don't see it having a big market impact at this stage.
I think that's enough from us this week. Sorry, I think I hogged that and spoke for way too long, but there we go. I promise to speak less next week. Thank you both for joining me. Thank you to our listeners for listening in. And just a reminder, if you liked today's episode, please don't forget to hit the like button and click subscribe so you can get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. Thanks. See you next week.